I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
All 12 episodes of The Passage are available now.
Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courtney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
Hello. From Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. This month, we're bringing you the stories of disappearing acts. There's the 17th century fraudster who convinced men she was a German princess. The 1950s folk singer who literally drove off into the sunset and was never heard from again. The First Nations activist whose kidnapping and murder ignited decades of discourse about Indigenous women's disappearances. And the young daughter of a Russian czar whose legendary escape led to even more intrigue and speculation. These stories make us consider what it means to disappear and why a woman might even want to make herself scarce. Listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, hello. How've you been? This is Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and I'm your host, Liv, here with part two of what I'm calling the Pandemic Fever episodes on Aristophanes' frogs. Perhaps fever isn't the best word for this, given the situation. I was going for a play on cabin fever, but I just don't think it works. Anyway, the point is, fun episodes of hilarity. So we're back to finish the story of Aristophanes' great comedy, The Frogs. You can also stay tuned to the feed later in the week for the next episode of me reading you the Iliad. Seems like a bunch of you were happy with that episode, so I'll keep it up. Honestly, I know a lot of you just enjoy my voice, and some use me to fall asleep, so episodes like that seem like a perfect bonus ASMR situation where you can just hear me, even if the translation is pretty old and clunky. You don't even really have to pay attention. Those will come out Thursdays for the foreseeable future. Where we last left our very comedic take on Dionysus and his servant slash slave Xanthias, they'd finally arrived in the underworld and had quite the encounter at the doors of the palace. Lots of switching outfits, for good or bad, much debate on who is in fact a god and who is not, where no real progress was made. All following, of course, one of the most truly joyful experiences I have had in researching and recording this podcast, the fucking chorus of frogs. They were such a goddamn joy. And so Dionysus and Xanthias were, in the end, invited into the palace of the underworld by Iacchus, one of the judges, under the guise of being brought before Pluto and Persephone, who will determine which of them is a god. Spoilers, that doesn't happen. This is episode 75, Battle of the Poets, Euripides versus Aeschylus, Aristophanes, The Frogs, Part 2. Dionysus and Xanthias have been invited into the palace of the underworld where everyone's favorite couple resides. But sadly, we won't meet the couple made extraordinarily famous by a webcomic. No, for now, Xanthias and a slave of the underworld are doing some work, having a nice chat. They discuss their roles as the slaves of these powerful gods. The basic premise? They do what they can to spy on their masters, listening for gossip that they might then spread around to anyone who'd listen. They bond over this, and the way they're both willing to shit-talk the people that own them, it's kind of nice, I guess, that if you have to be slaves in a play, they get to shit-talk the slaveholders. Of course, it's all meant to be very comedic, but at the same time, they do make them nice and sympathetic characters. So, you know, it's something. In the end, though, Xanthias asks his new friend what he's hearing through that nearby door. "What's going on in there?" he asks, motioning to where the yelling can be heard. "Oh," says the new friend, "well, that's Aeschylus and Euripides." "And what's happening?" Xanthias asks. "Oh, well, there's quite the upset down here lately. Nearing civil war, really," the older slave of the underworld tells Xanthias. "See, down here, when it comes to the arts, whoever's the best in their field gets to have dinner next to Pluto, the guest of honor, you could say. It's a tradition down here. And if someone else dies and joins us down here that is perhaps better than the person who's been having the dinners next to Pluto, well, then he has to give up his seat to the new guy. Whoever's best, that's the rule." "So what is it that's got Aeschylus all worked up?" Xanthias asks. "Well, since he's been dead, he's had the seat for tragedy, the best of the best." "And someone's taken it?" "Well," the slave replies, "then, see, Euripides showed up down here, and he's been showing off to everyone around, mainly to a group of some of the roughest guys down here. Murderers, burglars, you know the type. He's been talking himself up, and so these guys decide, hey, we think Euripides is the best. So in goes Euripides, takes a seat next to Pluto, and shoves Aeschylus aside." A quick side note, let's be honest here, Euripides is the best. This play is about to turn into an argument for who's the best, but, like, Euripides is the best. Ugh, God, it's obvious. "So was Euripides kicked aside? Aeschylus reinstated?" Xanthias asks. "No, you see, these guys down here, they claim they get to decide who's best. They've made a real loud ruckus about it, too. All saying it's Euripides who deserves the seat," says the slave. "And no one's defending Aeschylus?" "Well, there aren't that many particularly good people down here. Just look around," the slave replies as he waves his arm toward the audience. Again, the shade throwing. I love it. Also, love the implication here that only shitty people think that Euripides is the best. And I mean, sure, given I love Euripides because he's the darkest, most violent, most sympathetic to women, I think all those things would qualify me as a bad guy in the underworld. So be it. "So what's Pluto going to do about it?" Xanthias asks the slave. "There's going to be a contest," replies the slave. "A proper contest, too, all legal, with judging and measuring." "And what about Sophocles?" Xanthias asks. "Oh, well, when Sophocles ended up down here, he went up to Aeschylus and he basically just conceded he didn't want to take the seat from him, even when Aeschylus offered that it could be his. Nope, Sophocles tells him, it's yours. But now that there's a contest, he's on hand. You see, if Aeschylus wins, Sophocles stays away. It's Aeschylus' seat. But if Euripides wins, oh, well, then Sophocles will go up against him, too." Poor Euripides. I mean, honestly, the hate, the disrespect, the man is the best. Also, some context here that I've learned since I released last week's episode. It seems that Sophocles had really just died by the time this play was being performed. It was already mostly written by the time he died, and so he isn't featured in this contest in the underworld. He hadn't been dead when the majority was written. But once he died, Aristophanes knew he couldn't just not mention the guy, so instead he added in little snippets like this. "It's really going to go down then," Xanthias notes dramatically. "It is," replies the slave. "And right here, too. They want to weigh the weight of the poetry right in this spot." "Weigh the poetry?" Xanthias asks, confused. But before the slave can answer, more slaves come out of the door on stage, carrying a very intricate set of scales. They set it up on the stage, along with seating for the contest that's about to take place. "Oh, yes," the older slave answers Xanthias as things are being set up. "It'll be weighted and measured with rulers and compasses and, oh, you know, all the things to figure out who's the best tragedian." "And who will be the judge?" "That's the trick, isn't it?" says the slave. "It's hard to find anyone clever enough. Certainly all the men down here aren't smart enough for something like this. Quote, none of them could tell a poet from the hind leg of a donkey. Instead, they've had to settle for your master," he tells Xanthias. Xanthias and the underworld slave retreat back inside, being replaced with the chorus, tragically not the frog one. Dionysus, who sits on a very fancy throne, a group of so-called distinguished dead who are there to watch, and of course, the stars of our show, Aeschylus and Euripides. They're arguing right from the jump, yelling at each other as they walk to their places on the stage. Before we hear from these poets, these famous tragedians, the chorus prepares us. A brief play-by-play of what's to come and what's already started. These two very smart, very poetic men defending themselves in their trade. Oh, what a show! The very second the chorus is finished, Euripides is in, making himself known. Why should I drop out? He announces. It's simple. I'm the better poet. Anything to say to that, Aeschylus? Dionysus, their judge, asks. But Aeschylus doesn't answer. He's just too angry for words. A little cliche for you, isn't it? Euripides chides Aeschylus. Such an Aeschylean response. The intentional silence. Now, says Dionysus. That's a bit too sweeping of a statement, Euripides. To which Euripides replies by calling Aeschylus uncultivated, that he has no restraint. Quote, just a torrent of verbiage, stiff with superlatives and padded out with pretentious polysyllables. Hard to tell if this is meant to be ironic or is just a result of the translation. Either way it works. It's probably the former. Aeschylus quips back about Euripides' rustic ancestry and questions the characters of Euripides, calling them threadbare and commonplace. Dionysus tries to reel Aeschylus back, but he can't be contained. He notes that Euripides fills his play with unsavory topics like incest. Which, I mean, seems like it should be an insult tossed at the man who wrote Oedipus Tyrannus, but who am I to judge? Before Aeschylus can hurl another example of unsavory topics at Euripides, Dionysus stops him. He literally pushes the man into his seat and asks Euripides if he wouldn't like to move back. Quote, I wouldn't want you to get hit on the head by a principal clause and give birth to a premature tragedy. The wordplay, you guys. The wordplay. I just cannot. Most of this dialogue is weaponizing grammar in a way that is wildly enjoyable, and I wish I could quote more, but such is life. You should read it. Like I said, this edition was like $5 Canadian, so I am sure it is affordable as hell everywhere. Just saying. Aeschylus, Dionysus adds, you need to calm down. Surely two men of your stature can debate without it turning into a screaming match. Euripides, though, assures Dionysus that he can handle it. Come at me, he tells Aeschylus. Criticize whatever you want. Pick a play, any play. And he lists off a number of plays, tragically all of which are fragmentary or lost completely. Oh, well, Aeschylus counters, in this type of contest, I'm at a loss. You see, all my plays have survived after me, so I don't have them with me. Yours died with you. An ironic statement in hindsight, given we have way more of Euripides' plays today than any other playwright, but I'm biased, again, because I fucking love his work. Before we begin in earnest, Dionysus notes, getting everyone's attention, we must perform the necessary rites. He does the necessary rituals, pouring libations and the like, before calling for a hymn to the muses. The chorus sings to the muses, calling upon them to come and watch the contest, these women who control the very concepts of creativity. Next, the playwrights must show their respect to the gods. Aeschylus calls to Demeter, thanking her for nourishing his brain and hoping aloud that he's worthy of her mysteries. But Euripides declines to take his turn in prayer to the gods, saying that he prays to other gods. What, your own pantheon? Quips Dionysus as a joke, but Euripides confirms. This is interesting, the idea that Euripides prays to other gods. It's probably a commentary on how he tells his stories. His stories are often about normal people in place of gods, Medea, for instance. His plays examine the world in a very different way from Aeschylus' work, which is traditional, about heroes and worship of the standard gods. Which, of course, is why I prefer Euripides, but why he was perhaps not quite as appreciated in the theatrical circles he ran in. He's edgy. The contest from here begins to take form. The men provide pros for themselves, cons for their rivals. Euripides takes issue with the use of silence in Aeschylus, accusing him of bringing dramatic characters on stage and having them sit idly in silence for most of the play. Euripides uses the example of Niobe, but when it comes to plays I'm most familiar with, the obvious example here is Cassandra. In Aeschylus' Oresteia, Cassandra is on the stage in utter silence for a great majority of the play. It's making a point, it's dramatic, but Euripides finds it lazy. "All my characters speak," is his counter to this accusation on Aeschylus. "Women, slaves, masters, old crones, they all speak," Euripides says of his own work. He goes on to accuse Aeschylus of featuring mythical beasts, nonsensical creatures where none are necessary, or of jumping into a story right in the middle of things. "My prologues always lay out where we're at right at the top," Euripides says. Of course, it's clear from much of their arguments that it's simply a matter of taste. I prefer Euripides, without question, but many of the things he's criticizing Aeschylus for are great plot devices, in medias res, beginning in the middle of everything, or the very dramatic use of a silent woman on stage. Though, at the same time, Euripides giving women real lines and real character traits is why I prefer him. It's all relative, boys. But that is not the answer they are looking for. The contest goes on. Euripides continues his criticism of Aeschylus with a familiar through line. "Aeschylus," he says, "is always using excessive, fancy words. It's all very highbrow and not in a good way. Whereas Euripides speaks to the masses," he waves towards the audience, using them as his example. "I tell stories of the types of people these folks are familiar with." He explains that he's taught people to use logic by including it in his plays. He's taught them to ask questions in their daily lives, how to run their homes, when to ask, "But why is it this way?" Dionysus, though, their lofty judge, isn't falling for Euripides' argument, even though, personally, I am. But I'm not judging this. Dionysus mocks this claim by Euripides, noting that, yes, these days all Athenians return home and start asking endless questions of their servants. "Why is this here? Why have you done that?" Meanwhile, before, all they did was come home and sit in silence, facing a wall. It's the chorus's turn to have their say, and they want Aeschylus to speak. It's clear who they think should be the winner. They root for Aeschylus to finally speak his mind, calling him the great poet of the age. This, it seems, is what he needed, which makes sense, as Aeschylus did love a good chorus. Aeschylus speaks, and, well, Aeschylus sounds pretty sanctimonious to me. Anyway, he's going on about how he wishes he didn't have to do this, but he supposes he'll have to stoop to Euripides' level so as not to be accused of not defending himself. He's all very collective and conservative-sounding, very dry and old, and maybe that's why I'm being so biased in this interpretation. Regardless, he asks Euripides, "What makes a good poet?" Euripides says that it's about teaching the audience something, to make them into better citizens. "And if the poet doesn't do that," counters Aeschylus, "if they present good and noble men as villains..." "Death!" Dionysus jumps in without waiting a beat. "It should be death for that poet." "My heroes," continues Aeschylus, "are always that, valiant men, heroes through and through." "And how did you show this in them?" Euripides asks. "Why, by putting them in a wartime drama. After one of those plays, men couldn't help but wish to go out and defeat the enemy." Aeschylus continues to hype his plays, listing many wartime stories he's told, likening himself to Homer, who, he says, is so important now because of what he talks about with war strategy, weapons, the like. This Aeschylus, though I can't say about the real one, seems overly concerned with war, far more than art. This does track, though, as Aeschylus himself was a war hero, having been in some of the most famous battles of the Persian Wars, and most of his writing was done when Greece was at war with the Persians, and so most of it is about war. Continuing his high and mighty tone, Aeschylus notes that his plays depict men of valor, strong and brave, and that, quote, "I didn't clutter my stage with harlots like Phaedra and Sthenobia. No one can say I've ever put an erotic female into any play of mine." If you could see me right now, you'd see my eyes roll into the back of my head. Euripides quips back, quote, "How could you? You've never even met one." Good one, Euripides. And again, why I prefer you. Gotta love to be proud that you don't feature women in your plays. Ah, the ancient world. And the current one? Aeschylus goes on to accuse Euripides' depictions of women like Phaedra and Sthenobia of causing so-called decent women being so shocked that they go off and poison themselves. I do believe we can assume this not to be true. "Did I invent the story of Phaedra?" is Euripides' incredibly apt response, basically saying he's simply portraying the women that the mythology's given us. All the power to you, my man. Aeschylus says that, of course, those things happen, but that it's poets' jobs to stay silent, not to portray awful things like that. Anyway, Aeschylus is being a bit of a turd in this section. He continues on, aided by Dionysus, in basically accusing Euripides of having, in some way, caused the degradation of their society. People aren't playing sports anymore, they're debating instead. The horror! I don't know, it sounds like Athens has found a level of freedom, of excitement, a bit of debauchery, and these men can find a way of blaming Euripides for it. Euripides, I'm here for you. You're awesome.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
All 12 episodes of The Passage are available now. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello. From Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. This month, we're bringing you the stories of disappearing acts. There's the 17th century fraudster who convinced men she was a German princess. The 1950s folk singer who literally drove off into the sunset and was never heard from again. The First Nations activist whose kidnapping and murder ignited decades of discourse about Indigenous women's disappearances. And the young daughter of a Russian czar whose legendary escape led to even more intrigue and speculation. These stories make us consider what it means to disappear and why a woman might even want to make herself scarce. Listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courteney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
Next, we're going to prologues. Euripides says that Aeschyluses really are atrocious and simply don't set the scene at all. He uses Aeschylus's Libation Bearers as an example. That's the play that takes place right after his Agamemnon in the Oresteia. Orestes at the tomb of his father, who's been killed by Clytemnestra and Aegisthus. Aeschylus reads a few lines, and Euripides is there to tell him there are just countless mistakes in those few lines, let alone the rest. They fight over language, the use of particular words over others. The audience sides with each, in turn, for different reasons. All in fighting over whether one can confidently claim that Orestes both came to his homeland and returned to it. At one point, emphasizing why I won't try to break down what they're saying in too much detail for you all, Dionysus simply exclaims, quote, "Brilliant, brilliant! Wish I knew what you were talking about." Their arguments, needless to say, are detailed and nitpicky to a fault. They go on, next with Aeschylus criticizing Euripides' prologues, which Aeschylus decides he can break apart with a bottle of oil. This leads to, well, Euripides reciting lines from his prologues, and Aeschylus interrupting him to simply state, quote, "lost his bottle of oil." I want to understand this. I'm sure it's clever in some respect, as the characters in the play certainly believe so. I, however, do not get it, and the commentary I've found for the play does not explain it to me. So I cannot explain it to you all. Such it seems, is life. Okay, I'm keeping all that, but a cursory Google with no academic backing suggests it's parodying the predictability in Euripides' prologues. As I love Euripides, I don't see how that tracks. Euripides is great. Anyway, they continue this thing with the bottle of oil a while, like pages. He reads so many prologue beginnings, and Aeschylus substitutes lines for lost his bottle of oil many, many times. Maybe it works better in the ancient Greek. Aristophanes is funny as hell, so we should probably trust that it too is funny as hell, somehow. In the end, Dionysus is very much in on this bottle of oil joke, and forces Euripides to concede that he has lost this one, and that he should move on to further non-prologue criticisms of Aeschylus. So Euripides moves on to verse. He begins to sing verses he claims are from Aeschylus' songs and all have the same point. In this case, phrased in the same way, that all the songs include calls for help that the singers cannot hold out much longer. This joke is clear. He's saying they're all the same, that he can sing one and sing them all. None of this bottle of oil nonsense. Dionysus agrees, though he allows Aeschylus to counter. Aeschylus, it seems, has prepared his mockery of Euripides beforehand. He whips out a scroll and begins to recite. He recites endless lyrics, seemingly in mockery of Euripides. Modern, simple language, the opposite of Aeschylus' own. I don't get it. But enough, Aeschylus announces once he's finished reading his scroll. Let us finally put this to the test. Bring out those scales. Let's weigh the poetry to see finally whose is weightier. His, he indicates Euripides, or my own. So the scales are brought forward, and Pluto himself, king of the underworld, pokes his head out of a window on stage. Dionysus positions the poets on stage. Each holds a pan of the scales. He tells them, when he orders, they'll each recite a line of poetry while holding their section of the scale, and Dionysus says, quote, when I call cuckoo, you both let go. In terms of physics, this is all still very confusing, but then it is a contest of poetry in the underworld. Each poet recites a line. Euripides speaks of the Argo and its winged sail. Aeschylus speaks of a watery veil. Cuckoo! Dionysus yells, and both men let go of their sides of the scale. One sinks on the side of Aeschylus. Would you look at that? Dionysus notes. This one's going right down. How could that be? Asks Euripides, annoyed. Well, he spoke of a watery veil. You spoke of a winged sail. Quite obviously, one is heavier than the other, Dionysus explains as though, duh. Here, try again, he tells them, and the men get into position once more. They try again. Euripides with the line about persuasion, Aeschylus with one about death. Once again, Aeschylus' side goes down. He talked about death, Dionysus states immediately, if that isn't a heavy word. Euripides is, rightly, annoyed by the way this is going, so he thinks long and hard about his next line, trying to come up with the weightiest of poetry. Finally, he's got one. Euripides goes with a line about an iron weapon, Aeschylus one about corpses and chariots. Again, Aeschylus' side of the scale sinks toward the ground. Corpses, nice and heavy, says Dionysus. At this, Aeschylus very haughtily announces that this is just not fair for poor Euripides, and that he'd happily let the poet jump right on the scale himself and add his wife and children and all his plays. Still, Aeschylus says, quite sure of himself, I would beat him with just a couple of lines. In this class war that late-stage capitalism has given us, Aeschylus is the billionaires and the landlords. I don't know if that makes any sense, but I'm saying it anyway. After this royally dickish statement, Dionysus jumps in, announcing that, truly, he likes them both so much for such different reasons. He doesn't know how he'll choose. Enter Pluto. I mean, like I said, he was already there with his head out the window, but now he speaks. The god of the underworld tells Dionysus that he's more than welcome to take one of these poets back with him, since that's what he's come for. No point in leaving empty-handed. Oh, perfect, says Dionysus, seemingly as though he's always remembered that that was his original intention in visiting the underworld. But I don't believe him. I, for one, forgot that that was the point of all this. Why do you want a poet? Euripides asks him. Oh, well, obviously to save the city. If we don't save the city, there won't be any more plays performed, and then where will I be? So, Dionysus says, the man with the best suggestion of how we save the city will come back up with me. Here's my first question, he announces. What should we do about Alcibiades? Alcibiades, a man whose name I hope not to have to repeat too many times, was a political figure in Athens. Well, what do Athenians think? Euripides says. Oh, you know them, Dionysus replies. They love him, they hate him, all at once. Both poets answer with their thoughts about Alcibiades and Athens, and both Dionysus seems to like, not being able to decide between them while simultaneously joking that he can understand neither of their responses for similar yet different reasons. This goes on, with Euripides reciting more nonsense that sounds very smart and well thought out, but means absolutely nothing. It's intelligent gibberish. Quite funny, though. Aeschylus unknowingly makes a joke about the quality of people residing in Athens right now. According to Dionysus, they're shitty. Everyone laughs quite heartily. Pluto, though, is wishing they'd hurry the fuck along. Would you just decide? He asks Dionysus. Euripides takes this opportunity to plead with Dionysus, claiming that Dionysus swore to the gods that he'd take Euripides with him. But, alas, Dionysus goes with Aeschylus. How could you betray me like that? Euripides is distraught and calling upon a promise I don't know that we've heard about before. Would you just let me stay here to die? Euripides asks dramatically before amending it, or remain dead here? He finishes a little less dramatically. Eventually, poor Euripides is forcibly removed. Dionysus has made his decision. It's the wrong one, but he's made it. And I'm definitely not biased in telling this story. So, Dionysus makes his horrible, wildly wrong decision in deciding to bring Aeschylus back with him. Euripides is dragged off stage. Ugh. And Pluto, reserving any sort of judgment, offers the two that they should come inside the palace. He'll host them before they make their way from the underworld and back to Athens. They enter the palace, and the chorus sings. The chorus sings about how troubling the people running Athens are right now, how they've forgotten what they can learn from tragedy, how they're all losing sight of what matters. It's very frank and very aimed at the very real people running the city. They sing about how glad they are that such a reasonable and intelligent man like Aeschylus will be returned to them. I still think it should have been Euripides, though. Once the chorus has had its say, the men exit the palace for their last hurrah on stage. Pluto hands Aeschylus a number of items which he says are for very specific Athenian men, who he straight up names. This knife is for Cleophon, he says. These nooses for the tax commissioners. This bowl of hemlock is for Archinomus. And he names others. Aristophanes is out to fuck with the social order, it seems. Tell them all I'm waiting for them, Pluto adds dramatically. Will do, says Aeschylus, before adding that Pluto should give his seat at the table to Sophocles. Who's certainly second best, and absolutely never in a million years should it go to Euripides, Aeschylus says. The asshole. Oh, friends. Aristophanes is truly a joy. That one was a little tougher to put into a story. I hope it made sense. I had fun. And that's just what we need right now. Can I just say, though, that this play has bummed me out in a way I wasn't expecting? Like, I know we'd lost so many of Euripides' plays, but this samples so many and references so many that haven't survived. And now all I want in the world is to read Euripides' play about Bellerophon and his other about Cadmus. Cadmus, you guys. There isn't enough in the world about Cadmus, and Euripides wrote a whole play, and we don't have it. I'm worked up. Thursday, I'll release another episode of the Iliad reading. And next week, honestly, I don't have any idea. I'm looking at things that are a bit more fun and entertaining for all of us. Plus, honestly, my download numbers are garbage right now because no one's commuting. So fuck it, let's just enjoy ourselves. I may revisit one of the heroes I covered at the very beginning of this podcast. Because, man, there's so much to say that I missed / just didn't research way back then. So screw you to the one person who left me a bad review because I redid the Bacchae and Medea to tell their stories better. And somehow I'm still stuck on that one bad review. I'll do what I want. Random person I forget. I'm losing it a little. Anyway, isolation is a crazy drug, am I right? Maybe use your free time to go write me a 5-star review in iTunes. That'd be chill. Stay safe. Stay healthy. I'm going to try to stay sane. Stay inside if you can. We are all in this together, at least. I am Liv, and I love this shit. Wash your fucking hands.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
All 12 episodes of The Passage are available now. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello. From Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. This month, we're bringing you the stories of disappearing acts. There's the 17th century fraudster who convinced men she was a German princess. The 1950s folk singer who literally drove off into the sunset and was never heard from again. The First Nations activist whose kidnapping and murder ignited decades of discourse about Indigenous women's disappearances. And the young daughter of a Russian czar whose legendary escape led to even more intrigue and speculation. These stories make us consider what it means to disappear and why a woman might even want to make herself scarce. Listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courteney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.